on a topic which complements what we had just heard, but reinforces the importance of this work. Are you okay here?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Migrant status and sexually transmitted infections.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Victoria Ojeda, and it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for inviting me to speak with you about our study looking at the relationship between migration and STIs in female sex workers in Tijuana.
In Russian. She speaks Russian.
I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors on this manuscript, and as well as our collaborators. And especially, I'd like to acknowledge the funders, the National Institutes on Drug Abuse, as well as NIMH, and in particular, the study participants for all their contributions. We couldn't have done it without them. So prior research has demonstrated that migrants tend to be at risk for STIs and other vulnerabilities. And so the research aim is to examine migration as a correlative HIV, active syphilis, chlamydia, gonorrhea, and any of these four STIs in Tijuana female sex workers. And we hypothesize that migrant female sex workers are more likely to test positive for sexually transmitted infections as compared to female sex workers born in Baja California. And I'd like to define migrants as women that migrated to Baja California from any other state in Mexico. And our study is cross-sectional. And I'd like to just point out here, Oralia has done a wonderful job in sort of framing Mujer Segura, the study from which my data are also from. And so I'd like to just point out a couple of things. I'm focusing today on Tijuana, Baja California, for a couple of reasons. First of all, Tijuana is home to about 50% of the state of Baja California's total population, so almost 1.5 million individuals. In addition, about 60% of the Tijuana residents migrated there from elsewhere, either in Mexico or other countries. So it's a very significant receiving state and destination state for migrants in Mexico. And in addition, Tijuana is just right across the border, less than 20 miles from where we are today, and it has one of the busiest port of entries in the world, really, with more than 53 million vehicular and pedestrian crossings annually. So this map shows you just a listing of where our participants from Mujer Segura, where they're from. We've got a total in of 471. And with the arrows, you can see the five states that are really the largest senders, more than 9% per each of these sites. And what's interesting here to point out as well is that traditional migration flows tend to emphasize migration from southern Mexico, but you'll notice that southern Mexico is really underrepresented in terms of our study population. In terms of some of the socio-demographic characteristics of the female sex workers, you'll see that they're pretty even similarly distributed between the Baja natives and the migrants in terms of their age. About a third have a spouse or steady partner. The majority of the women have dependent children. However, migrant women are more likely to have fewer years of education, with more than 50% having 0 to 6 years of schooling. Home ownership is really quite low in this population, and Baja California natives are significantly more likely to be speaking English as compared to the migrants to the state. There are similar years in terms of working as a female sex worker, so about 5 years for both groups. And there are differences in terms of their most reported occupation. So the female sex workers who migrated to Baja are less likely than the natives to report working as a street worker. And so that's notable as well, with 38%. Oops. With respect to sexual behaviors, we also see that migrants are displaying some protective behaviors in the realm of condom access and protected anal sex, as well as HIV testing. So I'd just like to point out, migrants are about 12% are reporting access, often or frequent access to free condoms. In terms of the condom use during anal sex, we looked at this as a protective global indicator variable. So that's either they often or always use a condom, or they just do not engage in anal sex. And so that's 81% of the migrants are not participating in anal sex or using protection if they do. And then also 68% of the migrants were reporting testing for HIV. And this is, again, at baseline. So that's important to point out. Now, with respect to our main question of interest, you know, what is the relationship between migration and STI infection? You can see here that there aren't differences in terms of testing positive for HIV between both groups. There are small numbers, but still we're looking at 11% and 6%. And what I'd like to point out in terms of active syphilis measured with titers greater than 1 in 8, Baja California natives are significantly more likely to be testing positive for active syphilis compared to the migrants. And in terms of testing positive for any of the STIs that we were looking at, migrants are less likely to be testing positive for any STI compared to their native counterparts. So that's interesting as well. And surprising. And so we put these factors into a multivariate regression, and we find that specifically for any STI, in other words, any of the four STIs that we're looking at, migrants are protected against testing positive for these infections, and that's after controlling for other sociodemographic and socioeconomic position variables as well. And so we're wondering, really, you know, what is it about migrants in this context that's making producing a protective behaviors? And one of the factors, at least in the U.S. literature that we see, is that time in the U.S. or time in the community matters. And so here I'm just presenting some global estimates of any drug use, and you can see that globally the natives are more likely to be consuming illicit drugs. Compared to the migrants, so 64 versus 42%. And if we start to look at time, I'm comparing here established migrants versus new migrants. And that's defined by an established migrant is a person that's lived in Baja for 3 or more years versus a new migrant is somebody that's lived there for less than 3 years. You can see again that established migrants, in other words, people that have been in the community longer, are more likely to be consuming illicit drugs. And you see similar patterns in terms of injection drug use. So that's among these two groups. So that's important to point out. And so we followed this up even further, you know, in terms of the multivariate analyses. And so this first table shows that what we are seeing is that the new migrant effect holds, in that new migrants are protected against testing positive for any STI, and this also holds for syphilis. But you'll notice on the second row that established migrants are not different from the Baja California natives, and that's the reference group. So again, we're seeing a diminished effect of time in Baja. Now, this is a continuation of that analysis, and so we also controlled for illicit drug use. And in this table, I just wanted to point out some of the drugs that are significant. And so you'll see the first row indicates that that marijuana is associated with syphilis, active syphilis. And notably, across every single infection, methamphetamine is remarkably impacting the women's risk for testing positive for these STIs, you know, ranging from 2.5 for chlamydia to 9.9 for HIV. And in other factors that were not significant were heroin and speedballs, which is heroin and mixed with cocaine, tranquilizers, and inhalants. Okay, so to wrap up, you know, one of the major findings is that, contrary to our hypothesis, the relationship between migration and STI positivity was inconsistent, and in fact, contrary to what the literature shows, which is that we were expecting migrants to be at greater risk for STIs, and we're finding the opposite effect. But what we're noticing is, you know, once you delve into this the issue, it's really the length of residence that seems to be affecting women's behaviors, and apparently also consumption of illicit drugs. And so in terms of some of the larger migration literature, you can consider that this is a healthy migrant effect that persists sort of initially as women arrive in Baja, and that their protective behaviors degrade over time. And so additional research is really needed to be able to understand what are the social norms and the networks in both the receiving and sending communities so that we can understand where interventions might be targeted. And in terms of regular testing for HIV and STIs, that's definitely needed for this population so that they can monitor their status over time. And finally, in terms of governmental and programmatic efforts, we need to be able to better identify, again, the protective behaviors that are being engaged in by the new migrants so that they can maintain those behaviors over time and avoid the other behaviors that begin to erode. Well, that's it. Thank you very much.
Very, very thought-provoking. I'd like to invite Dr. Strath D. from the University of California, San Diego, who has a new title or a new number of titles, assistant dean or monarch of the sea or whatever. Maybe you can fill us in what you are now. But any rate, she's has put together an absolutely wonderful team and works with other teams along the border too, and she will discuss what we have just heard. But I'd also like to hope we have a little bit of time for Dr. Amon at some point to maybe finish a few comments on the last section of his talk, which he wasn't able to give. But if we have any time, we've actually got 30 minutes. And we invite questions, please, questions. Yeah. And also regarding this last talk, something to remember is that one thing is these folks have found is that migration to the U.S. is actually increases risk for HIV amongst men, and this is something that we don't want to lose in the shuffle.
Thanks very much, Peter, and I want to thank Dr. Thomas and NIDA in particular. You know, the three team members that I'm happy to be here co-presenting with are all supported through NIDA. We're starting with Ms. and soon to be Dr. Loza as a pre-doctoral candidate with a diversity supplement. Dr. Robert Dice, who was supported through a T32 postdoctoral fellowship, and Dr. Victoria Ojeda, who's a scholar with a diversity supplement from NIDA. So your investment has really paid off. I'm actually terrifically humbled to sit here and to learn from them just as much. But just as important, and perhaps more important, are our colleagues in El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. My collaboration with Dr. Rebecca Ramos goes back a number of years, and she taught me about the other border. I know about the Canadian border because I'm Canadian, and the big brother to the south has influenced my thinking along the years, but I have a new perspective. And there's a number of trends that I've noticed throughout the speakers on this panel this afternoon, and beginning with Joe Hyman's presentation. He said that we cannot assume a linear acculturation along with movement of people. And I think that really speaks to some of the data that we saw. Because if we just assume that mobility confers risk, we're going to be missing part of the picture. For example, we saw in Aurelia Loza's presentation that if we look at different pathways into sex work, it's mobility was important as an influential factor into sex work for the older, the women who initiated into sex work older, but not for the younger women. For the younger women, it was actually more factors related to abuse and early substance use, and in particular, inhalant use. And in Dr. Ojeda's presentation, we see that mobility matters as well, but in the opposite direction, as one would suspect if you look at the literature, which always seems to suggest that when you move, you're a risk taker, or that you're subjected to new conditions that are going to put you at risk. In Dr. Ojeda's presentation, we saw it was actually the new female migrants to Tijuana had protective factors workers that conferred some sense of resilience, at least at the beginning, and that their time in Tijuana led to an erosion of those factors. So it's very important, I think, to take into account that these gender differences as well as some of the contextual and cultural influences. And when you turn to what Dr. Dice presented, that in the context of men, that deportation and mobility were both related to the diagnosis and the interruption of treatment for tuberculosis. So it was great to see that 80% of the drug users from Tijuana who had a lifetime history of TB were diagnosed in the U.S. That's super. But what it means is that they weren't being diagnosed in Mexico if they had developed their illness there. But unfortunately, the missed opportunity of following through with treatment for these folks meant that if they were deported, that they were going to be sent back without having received their full course of treatment. And of course, those of you who followed the news this past year with the patient who was on the plane, who had multi-drug resistant TB flying all around, who was potentially infecting all these people, somebody who doesn't take their medications is not just at risk of developing super drug resistant TB that compromises their own health, that compromises the health of the community. So to me, the bottom line of all these presentations, and I'm very much looking to reading Dr. Campbell's book on drug trafficking in particular, but all of these presentations really speak to the fact that we need a binational response and that we are creating pressures. It's not just the violence that we're seeing as a pressure and the drug trafficking, but it's also that we as a country are putting pressure on Mexico, and those pressures are coming back in another way. And so if we kind of just look at the United States, and so many maps of the United States you see just, it stops at the border. And yet we know that many of Americans are from other countries, myself included. And if we have this very narrow lens on what we're responsible for as a nation, I think that we're going to see more illness and more conditions that are going to create illness. So I think that there's a binational responsibility here. Both the United States and Mexico need to step up to the plate when it comes to recognizing that there's a problem, especially on the border when it comes to drug use, sexually transmitted infections, HIV and TB. And that we really need a binational response. And how we do that, I think, means that we need to sit down and talk to one another and learn the languages that we speak and the cultures that we represent. And once we start to speak that same language, I think we're going to come a lot farther, but we have a long way to go. So with that, I'm just going to end my comments there. But if the moderators will allow me to entertain some comments and questions for the panel, I think that they've done a remarkable job of dealing with a very difficult set of topics. And I think the best time left would be directed towards them. Thank you very much.
This is not going to move that far. I think you have to go to the mic. Yeah.
Just walk right up here.
So I reported data on baseline data from an intervention study that was going to focus on high-risk sexual behavior. So that was one of the eligibility criteria for that study.
Were using the same database, but somehow including people who were
Actually, I think we used the same data from the same study. In the last 2 months.
Right. The inclusion criteria had to at least have had unprotected sex once with a client in the last 2 months, because those are the behaviors that Dr. Patterson and his team were trying to change. So what these ladies did was ask a different series of questions, and yes, it would limit the external validity of the findings somewhat, but still, the internal validity, I think, is still there for the questions that they asked. No, it's a good question and an important one.
Yeah, sure, not a problem. Just I probably didn't go over it too well, and just because of the time constraints. So women at baseline, whether they were interviewed, they provided, they responded to a questionnaire, but they also provided biological samples, which were then sent to labs for testing to see which STIs they were testing positive for. So does that help? No, it was not. It was actually biological samples. Right. So because the study is not a migration study per se, we don't have not very detailed information on that, but we did not hear of anybody being forced into moving to Baja or to any of the other study sites. And in terms of the PIMPs, that was also not coming out as something significantly. That was in terms of a highly prevalent behavior, because it was asked in the questionnaire, but Dr. Patterson's here, so he might have additional comments.
There was, we had one bar, a complete bar of, we recruited in bars and on the street, and in one case there were, I think it was about 15 women who all left. And we don't know whether it was voluntary or not, but it was the entire bar population, and sometimes they freshen up the population. So, but we don't know whether.
And just to add, we actually have difficulty obtaining information from female sex workers about their PIMPs. And if anybody has advice in the Mexican context, we would like this, because if we ask the women, do you have a PIMP or do you have a manager? Or even if we take away those labels and say, is there somebody the proceeds of your earnings have to go to? Or does someone take money that you earn from your sex work? Only 3% say yes, and so it's very small, and I think the women are maybe afraid to report it, but we think it's certainly ongoing, and many of them have boyfriends who they have a quasi-relationship with that we would define as a pimp, but they may not.
Oh, do you want to, Peter, do you want to handle the question?
In response to Dr. Strathi, our old data from working on a CDC project many years ago with the sex workers in El Paso was that there were very few pimps, that they were very independent, that they supported one another and worked in groups. But we never found a lot of pimps. Rebecca?
We asked the question, do you give some of your proceeds, some of your money to someone else, and they would still say no. And it's, there's, I think it has to do with the way they perceive themselves and who they are, and if they admit that, then it puts them over a line, but I don't know.
Many years ago, it was in Spain, in San Ade, the sex workers who came here to, well, to teach their profession, really. And I saw a lot of families come, those new families, kids and all, they came, well, and interviewed some, and most of the time, they were, yeah, they were sharing some money, but it was kind of, I'm working, basically, and that.
Interesting. Yeah. I know there's two people who have had their hands up repeatedly. A lady in the back here, and then a gentleman over in the middle here. That's you. Sorry. Go ahead. Okay, I can handle the first one, and then I'll hand over the second question to Robert Dice. In the sex worker study, and Tom, chip in here if I misrepresent, we are now looking at different regions of the city to actually determine whether HIV and STIs are clustered geographically. Again, with NIDA's support, we have two different investigators, Dr. Kimberly Brower and Dr. Melanie Rush, that are supported to do GIS. So in our preliminary work shows that the zona roja is where most of the STIs and HIV are existing, even though that's where the zone of tolerance is. In Mujer Segura, the data weren't set up exactly to do that, so we're having to map, you know, behind, you know, back, going back in time. But what we have done is, in Dr. Ojeda's presentation, you saw that we asked women if they were registered with the municipal health clinic or not, and that tells you whether or not they were legal versus illegal. And actually, the women who were registered had lower STI rates and higher rates of HIV testing. Now, they're required to get an HIV test in order to work. Now, we're a little uncomfortable interpreting these data because a lot of women go underground, and now the prices for these permits have actually gone up, and we are uncomfortable with that legislation, and so we're trying to interpret this in a way that is going to protect the women rather than making them go underground.
One other point is we are looking at like the street-based versus the bar-based and whatnot, and you see variations in risk and all kinds of different factors there.
There was that actress once who forgot to thank, I think, her husband at the Oscars, and I forgot to thank Dr. Richard Garfine, who was my research mentor, so he's in the back. But thank you, Dr. Garfine. And so this is, he can actually speak to some of these questions as well, but about the QuantiFERON and hepatitis C. We did the testing for QuantiFERON. This was actually phase three of our El Cuete study, and so in phase two, we did testing for hepatitis B and C, and at that time, the hepatitis C prevalence was, I believe, over 95%, and so, you know, we basically stopped testing for it. That was a big report that was submitted to Salud Pública, the Mexican health journal, of the high prevalence of hepatitis C among injection drug users. So at that point, we decided to start testing for TB and see what we found there. So I think that might answer your question. Thank you. And the QuantiFERON results, where actually Dr. Garfine is, I think, delivering a talk in the next session with the QuantiFERON data. But we found a high prevalence, again, of QuantiFERON positivity or latent tuberculosis infection as well. I think upwards of two-thirds were testing positive for QuantiFERON, having been exposed at some point in their lives to TB.
I think there was one more question in the middle here with a gentleman who had his hand up for quite a long time, and then I'd like to turn things back to the panel for our guests from El Paso to be able to finish their presentations that were cut a little short. Was there a question in the middle here? No? Is it? Maybe that gentleman is gone. Okay, so if we... Oh, sorry. Oh, yes? Uh-huh. Is there, were there... In both Mujer Segura and in Proyecto Acuete, women and men who spoke either English or Spanish were admitted into the study. If they spoke another indigenous language only, like Zapotec, Mixtec, etc., then unfortunately they weren't allowed into the study because we didn't have enough... interpreters to be able to speak, but there were some that spoke enough Spanish to get by, and we found in both studies that there were very few that spoke only indigenous languages. So, but your point is very well taken. Well, because those numbers were very small, it would be very difficult to make those correlations. We are working with indigenous populations in San Quintín, Mexico, which is halfway down the Baja California Peninsula, and Dr. Garfine, who's here today, could speak about that to you after the session. He's in the white shirt and the tie, and he's your bride later, perhaps, gentlemen. So, okay. So if you'd like to have the opportunity to finish your presentation. Thank you.
I'm not actually sure that I'm going to try to finish the presentation. I'm going to actually invite people, if they have not already gotten a copy of the presentation, to take a copy. I don't know if we have enough for everybody, but you know, and take a look at it. And but I do have something, I think, a significant contextual comment to bring to people's attention to think about. Which is that there has been an enormous escalation in the level of immigration law enforcement and in the ways immigration law enforcement is carried out. So that, for example, there's many more legally mandatory deportations and actual felony charges. Deportation is an administrative process, and then there are various felony charges in immigration, so that people have spend time, much longer periods of time in detention or in prison, and they're deported, which is on their record, which makes it much riskier to come back to the United States, although they may very well be coming back to the U.S. anyway. We know for sure that the intensification of immigration enforcement is changing people's migratory behavior, and it is clearly increasing the unauthorized population in the U.S. because people do not cycle back and forth as rapidly. So gradually you accumulate a large unauthorized population inside the United States. People do go back and forth, but they don't go back and forth as quickly. And another thing that is worth thinking about is whether there's going to be what is the effect of increased costs of unauthorized migration, because almost everybody now is using smugglers, and the smugglers have gotten more expensive. And it's and you do things like build border walls or add border patrol agents. The likely outcome is that it becomes much, much more expensive to cross borders. And I would think that that sort of thing would interact with some of the other things that people on this panel are studying. How do you come up with $3,000, or it may be $5,000 or $10,000 soon, for sophisticated fraudulent documents, or for package tours to the United States, where people disappear from them? Because we're going to start seeing much more sophisticated, but also much more expensive ways of coming into the United States from Mexico and Central America, which has not been the Mexican and Central American pattern. And I would imagine that that would interact with some of the things that we're seeing right now. I'm going to let my colleague Howard Campbell make some remarks.
Well, since I studied drug trafficking, I just wanted to make one main point. I think the main point of our paper is that in studying borders and drugs, we have to look at interconnections. And so what I want to emphasize, my main point, is that Right now, the drug war is really destroying Mexico. It's really horrible what's going on. 1,200 people have died in Juarez this year, about 4,000 all over the country of Mexico so far, and that the United States has a lot of the responsibility for this. So in terms of looking at interconnections, I want to emphasize, first of all, the U.S.'s demand for these drugs. Secondly, that we allow so many high-tech weapons to go to Mexico. And thirdly, the U.S. government is pressuring Mexico to continue to wage this drug war, which is not working and is really hurting Mexico very badly. And so you have right now, the U.S. is encouraging Mexico to accept Plan Mexico, which would be $400 million to go to Mexico. Do you think that's going to lead to a less violent society in Mexico? I don't think so. I don't think it's going to lessen drug supply from Mexico or drug consumption in Mexico or even drug consumption in the U.S. If you look at the Plan Colombia, it was not successful. It just led to a rearrangement of how drug cartels worked in Colombia. I think you'd find the same in Mexico. So I think that in understanding these issues, we need to look at international connections between the U.S. and Mexico and try to clean up our own act first and foremost, and then after that, talk to Mexicans about cleaning up their act. So.
Howard, your point's well taken. I wonder to what extent, we just saw a study of Caribbean countries where people were returned for their, deported back to their native countries for various misbehaviors in the United States, and those are the people who then become this hotbed for drug trafficking, violent destabilizations of those smaller countries. It seems, and HIV and related, so it seems to be a similar pattern in Mexico, in the border towns is what I'm hearing.
Absolutely, so again the issue there is interconnections, and so the U.S. has to accept its share of responsibility and blame, and I think that we can only affect our own behaviors. We can't force Mexico to do things, and we shouldn't. And so if we can focus on our responsibility and complicity, that's the best thing we can do. I think that's step one in trying to improve situations.
I would just add that it's actually changing right now because there's large numbers of people who are in these sort of showcase raids who are just factory workers who are being deported or people caught at the border who are going through formal deportation proceedings rather than just being voluntarily returned. But the main stem, the main flow of people who are formally deported from the United States, as opposed to just being arrested and sent right back across the border, but formally go through process and deported from the United States, are still people who get in trouble with the legal system. So there's a kind of a negative selectivity of who gets sent home. And there's good documentation now that the organizations in Central America, like Mara Salvatrucha, originated with gangs in California, and as gang members were arrested and sent back to Central America and put into societies that were post-Civil War, post-revolutionary, extremely violent, the intersection of those two factors resulted in really terrific levels of violence, civil society violence in Central America. So the way the U.S. operates, which is cleaning its prisons, filtering through its prisons and deporting people, has this impact, like you were talking about, in the Caribbean.
We're almost out of time, but since I'm the discussant, I can, I won't take the last word because we actually have a question, but I wanted to agree with both of our speakers here that I think that not only the interdiction and the pressure that the U.S. is putting on Mexico is creating a destabilization across the country, not just in the border, but also as we create more disparity in the drug markets that used to be one drug market, now we're creating two drug markets on either side of the border, and we're going to start to see more people going from the U.S. down to Mexico to score cheaper, high-quality drugs. And in fact, we have an R21 that's supported by NIDA to examine those hypotheses. And you gentlemen would be excellent consultants for that, so I'll be picking your brains later. Yes, you have a question.
Just a comment that might have combined two topics here. I'm from Texas, and in a couple of our correctional facilities on the border that are privately run, what we're finding is now they are rapidly deporting if they suspect somebody has TB. So as soon as they have somebody that's a possible suspect, they will send them for an x-ray, but they send them to the bridge immediately. And so obviously we're increasing the TB population there. A few months ago, it was the opposite. They were keeping them longer because the judge was insisting that they be cleared of TB before they get deported. The result of that was they ended up with a number of TB patients in their jail for a year or more. That's an expense a private corporation doesn't want to have. So the result, at least in the last month or so, is they're starting to deport them before they report it to the health department.
Did she want to?
I'll just say one thing. Thank you for the comment, because it's always useful to know what's going on the ground. There was someone else who works with TB card. The only one thing I would just like to point out is that some of our diagnoses had occurred, I think the median again was 10 years prior to the entry of the study. So this is something that's changed rapidly with respect to deportation, and TB card in San Diego is now trying to address some of these things. And I know that at the recent TB meeting in March, the Customs Enforcement Division was presenting some of their data. I don't know if there's anyone here. Right. Right. They seem to, from what I recall, she mentioned that they had sometimes an easier time with people coordinating care with El Salvador, and where it was an air crossing, whereas when it was a land crossing, sometimes they would just get sent back into Mexico and get lost to follow up. So, thank you.
I want to thank this very eloquent panel and for giving us such stimulating presentations. It really engaged our thinking this afternoon. And I just want to say again, you know, I'm from the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and we've been collaborating with the geographers, because a lot of times, you know, you tend to stay, I'm an epidemiologist, you stay in that little field, and there's a lot to learn and to gain from this cross-fertilization, and we've been doing it with the geographers. Many of the people in this room are authors in the book on geography and drug addiction that is coming out any moment now. But we're doing, it was so successful, we're doing a follow-up symposium next April in Las Vegas, and I'd be happy to send you the call for papers, and Springer has asked us to do a second book, this time focusing on geography, drug abuse, and HIV/AIDS. So I'd be happy to share that information with anyone in this room who's interested. Again, thank you very much for a very stimulating discussion. Thank you.